it straight down the middle. Then it started to...
Something I want to ask both of you, because this sort of ties into what Kari just covered. You both came up in similar fashion in Australia. You've got a fine amateur careers you're looking back on, but you're ready now to go to the big stage, right? Bruce, in your case, coming to America on the PGA Tour. Kari, in your case, I guess, coming on the LET Tour, the European Ladies Tour, mm-hmm. back in I guess that was 1995 probably or so. How do you know that your game measures up to take it to the big stage? Is there a moment, a competitive moment, or are you just kind of a gut feel that, I think I can do this?
Bruce, do you want to go first or you want me to go?
No, you go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. For me, like I said, I think I would have stayed amateur for another year if someone had said, we'll send you to the British Amateur and the US Amateur, and I would have gained that experience overseas. But as it was turning pro, I couldn't get anyone to give me any money after I turned pro. So no one was going to give me money to go and play in the amateur event. So, I don't know if I thought I was 100% ready until my second professional event, which was the Australian Ladies Masters at Royal Pines on the Gold Coast. I'd played well in that event a couple of years prior as an amateur. And so, I'd done well in a couple of the professional events in Australia. So, I felt like my game was fairly close. I didn't think maybe for a whole year it was close enough, but I knew I could play well in Australia at least. So, but the second event of my professional career was, like I said, the Australian Ladies Masters. And I ended up finishing second to Laura Davies, but went toe to toe with her all day on the Sunday and was paired with her. So, and that was when Laura was number one in the world and dominating women's golf. So,
that gave me a fair way too.
she can. Especially back then when, she was out driving everyone by 30 or 40 yards.
Amazing.
But, that just gave me, put $25,000 in my bank account, which I thought I was a millionaire. Yeah. And then it also gave me the confidence that if I could compete against Laura Davies, then maybe I was ready to head over to play on the European tour.
Yeah. Bruce, for you, was it winning the Australian Open as an amateur?
Yes. Yeah. Even though I didn't want to turn pro, after Norman von Neider talked me into turning pro in 61, I felt like I could beat the pros again. When you beat Kel and Peter Thompson in a golf tournament, when you're young like that, you feel like you can beat anyone. But, I think I was ready when even though I didn't know it. I didn't know it, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Well, at some point, you just have to jump into the deep end, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you turned pro at age 19, 1994. Just for our listeners, we'll go through your professional record just a little bit. 56 professional wins, as Bruce had mentioned, 41 of those on the LPGA Tour, which ties Kari Webb for 10th all time. And you know who you're tied with?
Babe Zaharias.
Yeah, there you go.
Yep, one of the 13 founders. We'll talk a little bit about the founders, I'm sure, as we talk about the history of the LPGA Tour. But Kari won 15 times on the LET Tour, 13 times on the Australia Ladies Professional Golf Tour, a few times in Japan as well. We'd probably go another 10 minutes just reading all these player of the year, money leader. We'll touch on some of that, but I mean, you talk about accolades in terms of your success on both of the major tours. We talked about your teachers a little bit. I'm sure we'll talk about some of the caddies you've had over the years, but you started on the LET Tour in 1995, and then after a Rookie of the Year season there, You decided to come over. I guess you took a whack at Q School, despite maybe having a slight injury. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, prior to that, I actually won the British Open.
That's Laura one of Davies, your majors that I counted, too.
Laura Davies had said the night before that to a few people, if I won the next day, that that I would get membership to the LPGA. But it, at the time, the international events were excluded from any exemption onto the LPGA. So, so I had to go to Q School, which, you know, I'm really glad that I've had that experience. I know exactly what it's like, and you know, doing it once, never wanted to go back. So I got through the first stage of qualifying school and straight through to the finals. And in that period of time, I had some downtime in London, and the house that I was staying in, I was carrying a bag down the stairs and fell down and broke my wrist. So luckily it was only a hairline fracture, but it, at the time I thought that was it. I'll just pack everything up and go back to Australia, and I'll play in Europe again next year. Fortunately, my agent at IMG, Vicky Cumming, convinced me. Her parents knew a really good hand doctor, convinced me to at least see him. And before I went to Australia, just to see, and that doctor actually gave me a lot of hope that it might be all right. I think I was 2.5 weeks out, or 3 weeks out of the first round. Yeah, first round, like 3 weeks out of the first round of Q School. So about 2.5 weeks or 2 weeks of heading to Q School. Fortunately, you know, treatment I got, and, you know, being 20, I guess, I healed very quickly. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of pain there. And luckily we were playing in Florida in October. So the courses were all soaked and wet from the summer rain. You know, never really had any issue with it, thankfully. And probably lack of preparation going in there put, you know, lower expectations on me, and I ended up getting through Q School and finishing second, which was very, very lucky. And I was super happy that I was moving on to the US.
You mentioned the victory at the Weetabix Women's Open in 95. You did beat a pretty good player over there too, finished second to you, six shots behind you, Annika Sörenstam and Jill McGill. But I mean, to beat Sörenstam by six shots at the British Open was, that's quite a victory.
Yeah, I can't remember what I started. Annika didn't start the day second behind me. I was paired with Val Skinner in the last group on Sunday, and she got off to a fairly rough start, and I got off to a nervy start, but managed to make some really great pars early on, and that just sort of settled me down. And I really don't remember. I remember the beginning of that day, and I remember probably the last three or four holes of that day. And some would argue, especially the Aussies that were in the clubhouse watching me on TV, would argue on the 16th hole I played a very risky shot from behind this tree, but I ended up pulling it off and making a par and got to the last hole on the last tee with a really large lead. And my biggest memory of that week is every time my sight line off the tee was the British Open signage. And every time I looked up, I think I backed off two or three times, because every time I looked up, I was like, oh my God, I'm going to win the British Open. going from, you know, what, about eight, 9 months earlier, when I still wasn't sure if I was ready to turn pro, but that felt like the next step for me. And then, you know, 9 months later, I'm standing on the 18th tee with a five shot lead. And I birdied the last to win by six. So, you don't dream that big, that quickly anyway.
We're talking about quickly, after you get your card for the LPGA, it took you a long while to win, didn't it?
Yeah.
Second tournament. You go out there and win the Hell South. The second tournament you played, you shot 70-70-69 and beat Jane Geddes and Martha Nowsey. So that was that must have made you feel great, though, to win the second time on the LPGA. That had to be a great feeling.
Yeah, I think it was very overwhelming because, again, I didn't, you know, the week prior, so because I'd won the British Open the year before, the tournament the week prior was tournament champions. And that was really my first time seeing, you know, all the current Hall of Famers that were playing on tour were all at that event. You know, and the winners of the past couple of years were there. So all the big names of the LPGA were playing in that event. And I was very overwhelmed. Like I didn't really feel like I belonged. I remember the Monday of that week. So both events were in Orlando, but the Monday of that week of the tournament champions, you know, of course, as a rookie and a youngster, you want to get out there and practice. And that Monday was January in Orlando, and it was really cold and windy, really, really windy. And I was like, I've got to do some practice. I can't just do none. It was really a day where you shouldn't even go out there. And I'm like, I'll just go down to the far right side of the range. The range was, it was blowing hard left to right, down left to right. So I was like, I'll just go down to the far right side of the range and hit balls back into the wind and just, you know, just hit 50 balls, 60 balls, just to, you know, say that I did some practice.
And loosen up a bit.
Yeah, I got to the range and there was only one player on the range that day, and it was Nancy Lopez, and she was all the way down the far right side of the range, and I'm like, I'm not going down there, I'm not hitting next to her. So I went and hit the far left and just started hitting downwind because I didn't want anything to do with hitting balls next to her. So you know, so really fast forward to the end of the second week and finding myself even in a playoff and then actually winning, you know, it was, you know, I think I obviously knew from winning the British Open I was capable of winning, but I wasn't expecting that to happen so quickly. So it was definitely a whirlwind start.
Well, you must have set your mind at ease, though. You worried about hitting golf balls next to Nancy Lopez, and after winning in Hell South, you win again at the Sprint Title Holders Championship, the Safeco, and then you win AT&T LPGA Tour Championship, 4 strokes over Nancy Lopez. So you didn't mind practicing with her after that, did you?
Well, I think you know, I probably didn't have the same introduction to the LPGA as a lot of rookies do because I came to the LPGA having won the British Open. So I think there was already some respect there from the older players to begin with. And, you know, and sure, they'd heard about me. I think some of the Aussies had been talking about me before I'd actually come onto the LPGA. So even though I was overwhelmed by it, you know, I think as far as once I got inside the ropes, the blinkers went on every time. It didn't really matter who I played with. Although, like, I remember the first time I played with every Hall of Famer on the LPGA, I remember what tournament was and where I
really
was.
Isn't that great?
Because those are really special moments for me.
Wonderful.
And so, you know, sort of pinch me sort of situation. So, you know, and then obviously by the Tour Championship at the end of the year, you know, I felt like I belonged and I was a part of the LPGA by then.
So we've just kind of glossed over a 4-win,
yep,
sort of inaugural season on the LPGA Tour.
Pretty fancy.
I want to go back to one other. I don't want to skip over it because I think it might have been your first professional win. Would that have been the 1995 Golden Flake Golden Ocala Futures Classic? That's a long name, but
yes, it was. That was my first professional win, and a very special week in many ways. You know, probably more special than the win was the family I stayed with that week, Craig and Debbie Miller. They housed me that week, and I'd been staying in housing the few events that I played on the Futures Tour, and they were the first people I stayed with who had traveled to Australia and actually knew how big Australia was, and they'd sort of just gotten back from being in Australia. So, like, I got along with them really, really well, and then obviously ended up winning that week. And then the next time I saw them, they showed up at Q School. I finished second. And then the next time I saw them, they showed up at the Tournament of Champions. I finished second. And then the next week I won. And then the next time they showed up was the Sprint title holders, and I won.
Ooh. Come on down.
Nice. Keep them around.
They became my good luck charms. They're actually, they watched me win both my US Opens. I think we tried to count. I think they've seen me win about 12 or 13 times.
How about that?
And, you know, early on when we didn't have, you know, email or text messages or anything like that to say we're coming to this tournament, I sometimes wouldn't know if they were coming. And then when I saw them on the first tee on the first day, I was like, this is going to be a good week because they had showed up. So, so we still keep in touch now, and it was you know, winning on Ocala was very special, but I think the better thing to come out of that week was my friendship with Craig and Debbie.
Yeah, that's neat. Wonderful. So the Ocala win, would you look at the Women's British Open then that year as sort of validation of that first professional victory?
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a two on a par five to win a two-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, 1 in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. Did I Tell You About My Albatross?
Definitely. I think, the Futures Tour was definitely a stepping tour into the LPGA, but I knew playing on the LET was a level up. And then to win the British Open with LPGA players in the field, that was definitely, I wouldn't say validation, but I'd been playing quite consistently well over there, and I don't think I would have said I was going to win that tournament, but you know, it was a huge step in my own belief in what I was doing. Mm.
So we've talked about that first win on the year on the LPGA Tour, 1996. What a year that was, Bruce.
Oh, wonderful year. Well, you followed up pretty good the next year, too. Three victories. Susan G. Komen International in Plantation East Golf Course, where you beat Nancy Bowen and Kathy Johnson Forbes and Laurie Kane. And then you got your other major that I count for you that wasn't a major. You win the British Ladies Open again, the Women's British Open. And then Safeco Classic and beat Annika Sorenstam again. And you got the Revere Trophy that year for your wonderful playing as well.
Yeah, I think it was a very good follow-up year to what was, you know, essentially a breakout year the year before. I think, the best golf I played that year was definitely at the British Open at Sunningdale. I love that golf course, the old course at Sunningdale.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it?
Yeah, and I just played unbelievably there. I think I won by 7 shots. So I just, you know, it was that course just, I fell in love with it as soon as I saw it. And,
just
played unbelievably. Oh, 8 shots. Okay. Maybe I started with a 7-shot lead.
Yeah.
Yes, you had that victory sewn up early the last day.
Well, the thing our listeners would see, too, if they went through the record of Corey Webb is first British Open winning by 6, next one by 8. There were quite a few times in your career when you had a pretty leisurely walk down that 18th fairway, yeah. I think.
Yeah, I would say most of those times, though, I never felt comfortable until I got to the last tee. You've seen over the years in the history of golf that anything can happen, and yep. You know, I never counted my chickens before it was too soon, and I just kept my foot on the pedal until I was 100% sure that I was, you know, I had a lead large enough that I couldn't do anything to muck it up.
I think most of our guests have said, you know, if we've got dry ground the whole way on 18 with no water, I feel a little bit more comfortable.
A little better.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, as you said, you follow a breakout year in 96 where you were first atop a million a season. You won the Money Award. You won the Rookie of the Year, which was right after winning the Rookie of the Year on the LET Tour the previous year. You go into 97, you got 3 wins. As Bruce said, perhaps there's 2 majors. There may be a third because you won Avion later before it became a major too, I think. We go to 1998 with a couple of more wins, the first one being the Australian Ladies Masters at Royal Pines Resort, also by 5 over Hyunsoon Park and Annika. And that, I think, allowed you to go back-to-back there. And then the City of Hope in Myrtle Beach, right up the road from where I'm at, which was, I think, your second win there at Waukehachie Plantation East Golf Course by 3 over Meg Mallon. You talk about Mike McEttrick. There's a connection there, isn't there?
Yeah, that's right. Yep. Taught Meg for many years, or most of her career.
You know, you got a few wins under your belt. You're still pretty young. It's early on in your career. What's going through your head? What are you feeling?
I think if you could have hindsight back then, I think I would have, because I think because I won so much early, I think that's all that became important. And not that it hindered me the next couple of years, but I wish that I had known what I know now, and that, you know, to enjoy the process of what it takes to win a little more than just putting winning as the be all and end all. There was lots of other things and lots of other good golf that I played that, you know, I merely just took for granted, I think, because it didn't produce winning results. It sounds very braddish of me, but I know in 98, only winning twice, I was not happy with that. again, if I had a different process in place, there would have been lots of other wins along the way.
Yeah. And yet, Bruce and I visited recently with Betsy King. It took Betsy King a long time to learn how to win. It didn't take you very long.
I think
doing it the way Betsy did, she would have learnt those processes along the way. Like the when you're not winning, you learn to work out what your daily wins are, your weekly wins are, your monthly wins are, even if it's not actually holding up the trophy at the end of the week. Whereas I had wins very early on, and so for me that was it. Like a good week was a win and nothing else. That mentality caught up with me later in my career. It didn't really hinder me early on. It just pushed me and motivated me to push myself harder and harder. But I didn't really have a foundation for when golf became a little harder than I was making at the beginning of my career. Yeah.
So case in point, after your disappointing in your mind. 98.
It didn't take long. Let me be clear, my 23-year-old mind.
Yeah, that fired you up, though, because we went for 6 wins in 99. So you solved that problem rather quickly, like you have done on many occasions, it appears to me.
Yeah, well, actually, from 98 to 99, I changed to cross-handed putting. So that was really the difference between 98 and 99. I I just started putting a lot better and making more putts.
Why the change?
Still cross-handing today?
Yes, I'm currently cross-handed. Over the years, I've gone back and forth, but I would say cross-handed is by far the most successful putting stroke, but I have won tournaments, conventional too. So
okay.
I went to cross-handed. I was working with Scotty Cameron, and I had a bit of a cut stroke with my conventional grip, and we were just trying different things. And on one putt, without telling him, I just putted cross-handed, and he said, "What did you do there?" And I said, "I putted cross-handed." And he said, "Hit some more like that." And my stroke was way better cross-handed than it was conventional. So that was it for me. I vowed to switch. I think I worked with him in December. So, you know, our season came around really quickly in those days. And back in January, I was, you know, putting cross-handed.
Well, that's interesting. So if you look at other players that you know, and particularly some of the younger players coming up that maybe come out of the box almost putting cross-handed, maybe there's a thinking change. I mean, back when I was, you know, years ago, it was the change was brought about by something get a little twitchy and you just can't get the ball down your line. This almost seems like you just found a better way.
Yeah, well, I did. I did find a better way, but there was still that stigma. So this was 98 into 99, there was still a stigma with cross-handed that it was like one of the last resorts. I mean, people were using the broomstick putters and the longer putters, and so that essentially was the last resort. But it still was reviewed as a last resort with putting. But I didn't really look at it that way because, you know, it showed in tests that my stroke was better. And honestly, that's all I needed. I think I just, yeah. I had that information behind me that backed that cross-handed was the way to go. And really the biggest learning curve was just long putting cross-handed. The short putting instantly improved. So when you're seeing everything inside 20 feet go in or have a better chance of going in, you know, you're instantly going to
know that
was a good decision.
Yeah. So when you look back on your career and your record, I mean, typically the professional career will follow sort of a normal bell curve, and you kind of look at that peak period, and we're coming into that peak period for you in terms of results anyway. So as we start talking about 99, 2000 through 2002 or so, that seems to be the top of the bell curve. Did it feel like it at the time? Like, hey, I'm really, all my games kind of coming together. I'm in the right mental place. Tell us a little bit what was in the head back then.
I mean, I think I believe that. I don't think there is as much information and, you know, stats weren't as, you know, in depth back then to really, you know, to really say that you felt like there wasn't more room for improvement. I think I was always looking to improve, whether, you know, I was the best player in the world or not. Like, I was always looking for an angle to get better. But I mean, I can look back on it now and say that, you know, I was probably a little oblivious to what was how good I was playing. You know, just kept pushing myself to get better. It wasn't, you know, I don't think I took enough time to sit down and think, you know, this is crazy how good I'm playing. I just, you know, I think I felt like I worked hard and this was the result of all the hard work.
Yeah. So at this time, you're playing at the top of the women's game at this point. Was there any aspect of your game you weren't completely comfortable with? You thought, you know what, I need to shore this up a little bit yet.
Well, I think heading into that period, obviously putting was, I was a bit of a streaky putter. So I don't think I was ever a bad putter, but I was streaky. So like weeks where I'd win by 7 or 8 shots. You know, everything was firing and putting included. You know, I think, you know, I always felt like my short game was ever a learning process, mainly probably because of where I grew up. You know, the surrounds at Air Golf Club are mostly buffalo grass, which is sort of like St. Augustine grass here in the US. And, you know, I don't know how I ever learnt to have it, any sort of good short game learning off that. But, you know, talking to like Trigsy, when Trigsy came on board, he's like, well, you learnt good hands and you learnt, you know, how to be creative. But I really feel like that was the part of my game that throughout my career, I knew the littlest about at the beginning, and the part that I've learnt the most about as I got older and older.
Hmm. So we talked about this 6-win season, 1999, Office Depot, second time at the Australian Ladies Masters, where you just eked out a win by 10, including a sporty little, well, let's see, that was that was rounds of 67, 60, yeah, 64, 68, little minus. Was that a, not sure what that final round was. Oh, sorry. First round of 63. I should relook at that. Minus 26. Huh? Water or not on the 18th, you kind of just skipped down the fairway there.
Yeah, no, that was, again, some of the best golf I played, but probably some of the best putting for all four rounds that I've ever had. Royal Pines greens back then were probably the best Bermuda greens I've ever putted on, the most true Bermuda greens I've ever putted on. So, and they didn't have tons of break. So, everything went well that week.
Yeah. And then, you know, you go on to Arizona and win the Standard Register, your second title holders, you win by 3 over Annika. You go to Wegmans Rochester, which to hear Kathy Whitworth reminisce about how much fun she used to have going to Rochester.
Yeah.
And great tournament to the win there. And then you know, finish it up with what is, I guess, officially major number one. Yeah. At the Des Mauriers Classic, this is by 2 over Laura Davies, your first major.
Yeah, that. So that 99 was my fourth year on tour. So prior to the start of 99, I'd played 12 majors, and the media were, you know, I was labeled with the best player not to have won a major, and so every major I went into, you know, what are the keys to winning a major? And when do you think you're going to be ready to win a major? And so on top of the pressure I was putting on myself, those are the questions I had to answer in leading into every major. And I went into Des Mauriers. It was the last, you know, I was having a great year, obviously, and I hadn't played particularly well in the other majors. Went into Des Mauriers at Prudhoe Greens, in Calgary, and didn't feel great about things. My prep wasn't good. I think I ended up making the cut, one ahead of the number for the cut.
Bit of a slow start, wasn't it?
Yeah,
73, 72.
Yeah, wasn't great. I don't know what happened on the weekend, but you know, I think I just I thought that I had no chance to win. So I think all the pressure I've been putting on myself had just let off, and had a great third round. And I think I still didn't really, I mean, I had an outside shot on Sunday, but I still didn't really think I had a chance until I, you know, started playing really well on Sunday. And Laura wasn't really doing that much. And I knew I was ahead of her, and I could set a score. So, you know, that was just my goal. And the back nine was to get in as low as I could and see if it was good enough. And even when I finished, I think I thought it'd be good enough for a playoff, but it was well and truly good enough. So
yeah, sure it was.
Yeah. So I ended that year with the monkey off my back as far as majors went. And I knew then I didn't really need to, I wasn't going to have to answer those questions prior to going into the next major that started the next year. So that was relieving.
Yeah, it certainly started a great stretch for you in the majors. Of course, you finished 99, again, as the money leader, the player of the year, win the Vera Trophy. So another fantastic year, but you don't let off the gas the following year, that's for sure.
Boy.
Yeah, no, 2000 was my best year of my career. Besides just on the LPGA, I think I had 10 worldwide wins that year. So that was definitely my best year of my career.
Yeah, I think 7 of those probably came on the LPGA Tour. So in 2000, we're talking about opening up early in Florida at the Office Depot. That was your second win there over Julie Inkster, who we'll talk about in a minute. So you go back-to-back there. Then you win your third Australian Ladies Masters, giving you 3 straight there. You win the Women's Australian Open at Yarra Yarra, first of 5 wins in that event there, I think, for you. And then you go to Hawaii and beat Annika in a playoff 1 week after that Australian Open win. And then next thing you know, time for another major. Let's go to Mission Hills. Get my bathrobe ready.
Yeah, I always love playing at Mission Hills right from the very first year I played there. I'm my rookie year. The atmosphere was great out there. You know, the weather was always beautiful at that time of the year, and course was in perfect shape. And it still is today, more of a ball striker's course than anything, especially if they've got the rough nice and long. The fairways are tight. The course really demands, really good approach shots into the greens.
Kind of eked out a victory there again.
Yeah, another 10 shot, Lynn. 67, 70, 67, 70. Beat Dottie Pepper by 10 shots.
Yeah, I going into that last round, I think, I can't remember what my lead was. I think it might have been 7. But I was paired with Dottie and Ari Song. I think the Wong Glukiet twins, they changed their name to their song to their dad's Korean last name after they turned pro. But she was an amateur at the time, and she was in the last group. And my goal that day was not to let her beat me. So
and you didn't.
Yeah. So, but it was good because I had such a large lead. It allowed me to play still aggressively because I wanted to beat her. And early on in that round on the fifth hole, I had a hole of one. So, Dottie, I think that was when she just threw the white towel at me when that went in. She's like, well, I can't do much else now. You're holding it as well as making every putt.
Yeah, you can't feel too bad when you're getting beat by 10. We talked a lot about the history of the Dinah Shore over the years. Of course, we're calling it the Dinah Shore. At the time, it might officially been called the Nabisco Championship. But, we talked about David Foster and Colgate-Palmolive and Dinah Shore and what that tournament did for the ladies' tour back in the day.
Yeah, it was definitely those are definitely stories that all of the older players on tour when I first started were making sure that the younger players knew about. And, I wasn't fortunate enough to meet Dinah Shore. She had passed away just before I had come on tour. So I think that was still fresh in everyone's mind as well. But, I still call it Dinah. I always did. I understood the impact that she had on that event. The history that we have at that golf course is unlike any other in the history of the LPGA. It's a very, very special place in the history of the LPGA.
Sure is. Yeah.
Like your Masters, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, except we're not there anymore, so it's a little disappointing.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
Whack down the fairway. It went smack down the fairway.
Then it started to slice just a smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle. Quiet.